Hey everyone, thanks for joining us on the Fish Diversity Podcast. Fish are amazing creatures with a diverse set of colors, shapes, and sizes. They are truly a diverse group of animals. So are humans. This podcast is more about people than fish, which is also the case in fisheries, believe it or not. Any fisheries manager will tell you, it's about working with people. The fish are the easy part. Here we focus on people and on extremely important topics, including the benefits of diversity, equity, and inclusion in the field of fisheries and aquatic sciences. Some topics may be uncomfortable at times, but this will be a safe zone from which everyone can learn. Although this is an initiative led by Clemson University students and supported directly by the American Fisheries Society, it applies everywhere and to everyone and transcends fisheries. We strive for everyone to feel involved and included no matter your country of origin, age, ethnicity, gender, religion, sexuality, and disability. Hosts and guests are sharing their personal views, which they hold as their own. Thank you for joining us. I'd like to introduce the co-host, Dion Kerr.
Thanks for tuning in, everyone. As we begin to start this journey, Aaron and I would like to invite all of you to come prepared with an open mind, ready to think critically. I'd like to follow up that statement by saying, generally, humans struggle between what is right and wrong. Our personal morals and ethics are shaped by cultural norms and the ones that surround us, including our family, friends, classmates, and colleagues. Our podcast would like to critique your philosophy by challenging some of your personal beliefs regarding right and wrong. We want you to ask yourself this. Is the way I'm viewing this situation or issue correct, or is it wrong? What is it that I'm not seeing? These are great questions to start with, and it is very important to answer them honestly. Try not to find an answer based on what benefits you, but what's centered around the truth or what matters.
Hello, and join us in welcoming the Ladies of MISS, which stands for the Minorities in Shark Sciences. Ladies, if you don't mind, please introduce yourselves to our listeners.
Hi, I'm Jasmine Graham. I am a shark biologist specializing in movement ecology. My current research focuses on the movements of the small-toothed sawfish.
That's awesome.
Hello, my name is Jada Elcock. I am an incoming grad student at the University of Washington in the School of Aquatic and Fishery Sciences. Like Jasmine, my research will most likely focus on elasmobranch ecology, movement ecology. So I am very excited to get started with my graduate school career. And yeah, that's me.
Awesome. Thank you so much. Imani, what about you?
Hi, I'm Imani Weber-Schultz. I recently graduated from Rutgers University in May. I'm taking a gap year between doing more school, master's or PhD. And in that time, I'm working at Field School in Miami. My interests are in functional morphology, physiology, and biomechanics.
It's great to have you all here. It's great to see this initiative that you started. So let's talk about your love for the ocean, sharks, and why you chose this field of research.
I have always been really kind of, I guess, obsessed with the water. I've always loved swimming, whether it's a swimming pool, a lake, the ocean, anything. So I've always really been drawn to the ocean. In high school, I watched a lot of like Shark Week and a lot of shark shows. So I got really interested in sharks and kind of realizing that, though it's cliche, they are pretty misunderstood and we need to do more to make sure that we're helping them and we're not destroying their resources, taking up their space, killing them at unsustainable rates, everything like that. So I decided to join this field because I realized that if there were a group that needed my help, it was going to be sharks. So I figured that I wanted to be one of those people to help with conservation efforts and just help get more information on these animals so that we can work towards more efficient conservation efforts.
Absolutely, Jada. And I bet Shark Week gets a lot of people excited about sharks. People wanting to become shark biologists is probably pretty common out there. So I bet there's a lot of competition in the field, huh?
Yeah, definitely. But you just keep working at it. And I always say that if you want to do something bad enough, you'll make it happen. So that's kind of what I did.
Absolutely. I've had to do the same thing in my career. So what about you, Imani?
So the reason I got into it is almost the same as Jada. You know, realizing how important they are and also how misunderstood they are. People have a tendency to care about things that are really cute and cuddly. And sharks are not fuzzy and cuddly like lion cubs or something like that, but they're equally as important. Mm-hmm. And, you know, getting people to understand just how much they help this planet was something that was really important to me. You know, we have, as people, have a tendency to group a whole species into being one thing or a whole group of people into being one thing. And the idea of helping us, you know, stop doing that and realizing that all sharks are not, you know, out to get us essentially was really important to me.
And there's some parallels with that, with what we're talking about in terms of diversity, inclusion, and equity, really. And this podcast is what we're all about. about. Jasmine, what are your thoughts?
So I got interested in sharks, I guess, kind of accidentally. So I knew that I was interested in the ocean, and I grew up fishing with my dad, and I loved being on the water and going fishing and things like that. And so as soon as I figured out in high school that you could do marine science as a career, I knew that was what I wanted to do. And so I went to school called Charleston for marine biology. And then I kind of was wandering around a research matchmaking type thing and trying to figure out what all I wanted to do. And I visited some of the cliche like sea turtle folks and coral and stuff like that. And then I ran into a professor that was doing shark research, which I had never really considered. And he just was so passionate about it and excited that I decided to try and work in his lab. And then I really got hooked. And throughout college, I tried a lot of different things, but I kept coming back to sharks. And so I was kind of like, okay, this looks like it's it. It's sharks or bust. I tried ocean acidification. I tried microplastics. I tried everything else. And I just really like sharks. So I've stuck with that ever since.
Oh, that's so cool. That's really cool. Especially when you gravitate back to something, it really shows you're passionate about it. With Jasmine, what does your shark research entail?
So right now I am working on a project to track the movements of small-toothed sawfish, which is a critically endangered ray species. So a lot of my research is very applied and conservation-minded. And so whenever I was presented with the opportunity in my master's degree to start working with a critically endangered species, I jumped on it because it's really important to me to take my science beyond the ivory tower and make it something that creates real change. And so I started working on this project. And basically what I do is I tag sawfish, acoustic and satellite telemetry. And we're tapping into a lot of different resources for our acoustic arrays. So we have our own arrays set up, but we also are utilizing the FACT, ACT, and iTag arrays, which are basically a big collaborative effort of a bunch of different researchers that have receivers out so that we can share data. So whenever an animal that doesn't belong to us shows up on one of our receivers, we have a place that we can put that so everyone has access to those orphan tags, which has been really great. Actually had sawfish detected on over 400 different receivers. They were going all sorts of places that we didn't know that they were going. And so we had some people like at NASA telling us, hey, your sawfish are up here at Cape Canaveral like every summer at the exact same time. Like that was really exciting. And so we found out that they're moving a lot farther than we thought they were moving, which is really exciting that their range is kind of expanding a bit more. So in addition to doing all of that, the main purpose is basically to start to figure out some areas where sawfish are spending a lot of time because they're listed on the Endangered Species Act in the United States, which means that we need to identify critical habitat for them. And critical habitat has been identified for the small juveniles, but not for large juveniles and adults because they move in ways that are very different. My research is basically going to identify some areas that we should start looking at when trying to decide on what areas to designate as critical habitat. And then I'm also looking at the interaction risk of commercial fisheries and the small-toothed sawfish in their range.
Do you think that the sawfish extended their range, or do you think it's because we acoustic arrays were broader so that you were able to capture that movement?
That's hard to say. So historically, the small-toothed sawfish was found all the way as far west as Texas and the Gulf Coast, and then as far north as at least North Carolina. There's some reports up as far as New York, but we're kind of not sure about those. So the range was there, and then all of a sudden people stopped catching them in those areas. And so we assumed that they were only spending time in South Florida. Some people doing some eDNA stuff and trying to figure out where else they're going. But even with our expanded knowledge, we only had a handful of sawfish going up that far north. So I think that they probably stopped moving that far and have started back migrating a little bit farther. Mm-hmm. But I think that also is, it's hard to tell when that happened. It happened, 10 years ago and we just didn't see it happening, or because there's so few of them that we're not going to get captured and encounter data because there's just not a high enough density for people to be seeing them. So it's hard to say, but I definitely think that having the extra receiver coverage is definitely going to identify some areas that are unexpected, that we, that people aren't seeing them, but they're moving there. And so I'm really excited about all of that extra data and opportunity that we have to track these amazing animals.
So my two daughters and I just watched Pirates of the Caribbean. And it was funny because one of the pirates, one of the animated characters that were supposed to be these crazy sea creatures slash pirates was carrying a rostrum as a weapon. So that was pretty funny. And I explained to my daughters, it was kind of a learning moment that, hey, this is from a sawtooth. Pretty neat. Who else would like to talk about their research?
I have participated in, you know, physiology research with sharks and tagging. And then I've also done research on walking cavefish in Thailand with Brooke Flamang, but I have not done my own.
Hey, you were part of it. That's just because it wasn't associated directly with a study that you were leading. You were still part of that research. So that's cool.
Yeah. So since I haven't started grad school yet, I haven't started like my dissertation project or anything like that. But like Jasmine, I kind of hope to do some movement ecology work, just trying to find, you know, critical habitats, where these animals are going, where are their breeding grounds, where are their birthing grounds, where are these nurseries that the juveniles are spending all their times, because those would be the most important areas. Like these areas that I've just kind of mentioned would be like the most important areas to try to protect if we can. Movement information is going to be really important for conservation work. I have done a little bit of work with skates. They lay eggs. And so my mentor and I are currently working on a project looking at what kind of conditions affect how well skate eggs can stay in their nursery sites. They want to make sure that they stay in their nursery sites. That's the safest place for these eggs. But sometimes really fast currents can pull them away, or certain water pressures can affect how well they stay in the substrate. So we're just kind of trying to figure out what exactly are the conditions that they can handle before they break free from the substrate based on different species, because each species is a little bit shaped differently and feels a little bit different. So that's something we're working on right now that we're pretty excited about.
All right. Well, you know, that's the why. That's why you all chose to get into this field and study specific field of research. And now we want to talk about why you decided there was a need for the Minorities in Shark Sciences Initiative. So overall, what's the primary goal for the Minorities in Shark Sciences Initiative, otherwise known as MISS?
As for the why we started the initiative, so we all kind of felt like we were floating around in isolation. We didn't really know other shark scientists that looked like us that we could really identify with. You know, we grew up watching Shark Week. We didn't see anyone that looked like us. We still decided it was a space for us. But that can feel very isolating, thinking that you're the only one. And so whenever we figured out that we weren't the only ones, it was very exciting. And we wanted to share that same excitement and sense of community with other women of color in shark science to let them know that they're not alone. So we started this for a lot of different reasons. The first being we wanted to show the world that women of color exist in shark science and kind of take up that space and claim that space. It's very easy for people to say, oh, there's not women of color in shark science because women of color aren't interested in shark science, which is false. We're here. We're out here. We just don't get a lot of attention. We don't get a lot of citations. We're not the ones on Shark Week. We get overlooked. So we wanted to start this to kind of boldly and loudly proclaim that we're here and this is our space too. And then we also wanted to get more people through those barriers that we face coming into shark science, because there's a lot of gatekeeping, whether it's intentional or unintentional, that happens that keeps women of color out of shark science. And so we wanted to mitigate a lot of those barriers, the biggest being financial, which is why we decided to do the workshops, which would be fully funded opportunities that people that haven't had the opportunity to go and do research or get field experience with sharks, they can come to this weekend workshop, meet us, meet each other, have the networking opportunities, have the professional development seminars and things like that, and get the hands-on experience that they need to kind of get their foot in the door. And so that's kind of the financial piece. And then networking is a huge thing. A lot of women of color have issues because they feel isolated, finding mentors and connecting with people and kind of knowing what the next step is. So we want to make sure that we can guide people through the process and make sure that they have someone to look up to, someone to mentor them, someone to tell them, this is what grad school is. This is how you apply to grad school. This is how you do research. This is how you ask people about collaborations and things like like that and helping people get to the point where they feel comfortable walking into a shark science conference or walking into a lab meeting, and also being able to claim their space and say that I'm a woman of color, I belong here too, I have just as much right to be here as you do, and have the opportunity to do something that they love. There's a lot of women out there who love sharks, interested in shark science, but they can't figure out how to access field. And so we want to make sure that everyone that's interested in it has the opportunity to participate in shark science.
That's powerful stuff. I really appreciate you bringing that up. Is there anybody else who'd like to add to that?
I'll just add something that we kind of talk about a lot. Jasmine covered pretty much everything, but I like to explain to people that like diversity in people, like lived experiences and ways of life, creates diversity in thought. And without diversity in thought, you're just going to have a lack of innovative ideas and discoveries in science. So if you don't have diversity in people, science loses as a whole. It is obviously definitely about empowering women of color and making sure that we feel that we are all welcome in this space, because science is a place for everybody and should be seen as a place for everybody. But it's also about making sure that everyone is included in the process so that we can make the most discoveries and find out as much about these animals as we possibly can. Because I mean, at the end of the day, that's what every scientist loves to do. We love to learn. We love to find out about these animals. So if we don't have help from everybody and every group of people, we're not going to learn as much as we can. So that's just something I like to add as well, because I think that that's important.
That's the whole foundation for diversity and inclusion. You summed it up very well, as far as having that diversity in thought. And diversity in thought comes from diversity in experiences, and diversity in experiences come from people that are diverse. I think American Fisheries Society in general are trying to make some giant strides. And with initiatives like you ladies are doing, you're helping push that forward. Types of barriers. And you mentioned a little bit about that, Jasmine, and what you were talking about. But in your experience, what are some of the greatest barriers limiting minorities in science? And that's in general, but also specific to fisheries.
I mean, there's tons of barriers. I think the one that sticks out to me the most is just a mental barrier of thinking that you can do something, and the barrier that gets set up when you're the only person of color in that room. But when I was in kindergarten, I was the only Black person in my kindergarten class. And I told my parents as a kindergartner that I didn't want to go to college because I was going to be the only Black person. And I think that that has translated over to a ton of people in terms of science, because they look at scientists and they don't see diversity. And their first thought is, I can't do that because there's no one who looks like me. And that's a really tough mental barrier to get past. You know, all of us essentially decided that we were okay taking on the emotional weight of being the only person of color in a room. You know, that's a heavy weight to have. It is not something easy to deal with, both mentally and just like if you're going to go to a conference, your first thought is, am I the only person of color? Am I going to feel like I'm sticking out? Am I going to feel welcome? And so the barrier of just like not seeing anyone in your field can be incredibly saddening, and it can make you really not want to enter the field of science.
I'll say that some of the barriers, much like Amani just said, like this mental and emotional barrier can be pretty heavy sometimes, especially when you're doing everything that you can to push forward. And there are people that are still trying to tear you down, and you just have to try to ignore it. Like there are so many microaggressions that we experience, as well as outright racism. So I've had people be like, oh, you're going to study sharks? LOL, Black people can't swim. And I'm like, that's not funny, and a totally uncalled for comment. Like, why did you had no reason to say that? But I've gotten that a bunch of times. I've had people tell me that I got my GPA based scholarship into college purely because of affirmative action and because I'm Black and I'm more privileged than they are as a white man. And I was like, you should read a book. But then that's just the thing that like we have decided we're okay with dealing with. And obviously we're not okay with it, but that's something that we realize that we're going to have to deal with on a relatively regular basis. And we've decided that science is important enough to us that we will just deal with it or say something when we need to and take on that emotional burden and just move on, because that's just what you do. But at the same time, like you kind of, I like to say something every once in a while, but sometimes I'll just be like, well, watch me work. My work will speak for itself, and I will show you that Black women can do everything that you can do just as good. I promise you that I belong here as well. So it is that emotional and mental burden that you just kind of have to push through. And it is really frustrating sometimes, but science means that much to us. So we're willing to take it on.
Yeah, that's hurtful language. And that's not, you know, I hope that's that occurs pretty minimally for you. And I think personally, and I've said this in the previous podcast, it can be hard for me. Some people feel comfortable saying those things about other races to me as a white male because they think I agree and I'm not agreeable. That's tough. When somebody says that directly to you, it has to be demeaning. I applaud all three of you for continuing on and just pushing those thoughts away and saying, screw you. I'm not listening to that. I'm going to do what I'm going to do. It's awesome. And I appreciate that. I applaud that.
Thank you.
Jasmine, what do you think?
Yeah, so I definitely agree with a lot of what's been said, especially the affirmative action thing. It's like, I think literally every time I've won anything ever, I've had someone white say that I got it because I'm black. That's really annoying and hurtful because I work my butt off to get all of this stuff, and to have someone minimize it like that and assume that it was given to me because I'm black and that I didn't earn it is hurtful. And it also plays into what I think is one of my biggest challenges even today. And I've grown a pretty thick skin and I'm pretty vocal and I'm pretty good at taking up space and dealing with that sort of thing. But I still have a lot of imposter syndrome where I have to keep telling myself when I'm in a room or I'm giving a presentation and people are hounding me with questions in a way that they wouldn't if I were white or a man. I have to, you know, tell myself all the time, you're the expert here. You know what you're talking about. Don't let them make you feel like you don't know what you're talking about, because you do. So, and that I think couples with the challenge of stereotype threat, where I teeter back and forth of like my imposter syndrome. To get over that, I need to be very firm and strong and not back down. But then I run into the stereotype threat of being an angry black woman. So everything that I say, everyone's like, oh, I don't know why you're so angry. Or they don't take what I say as valid because they think I'm emotional and angry. And so I have a lot of people that tone police me, that say, I don't like your tone. I'm like, well, you're the one being dismissive here. So one of us has a bad tone and it's not me. And so that's really frustrating and annoying. And I also feel like my work gets scrutinized a lot more because I'm a black woman, which is really annoying that everyone has to question everything that I do at every step. But if I like wasn't me, if you took all of my ideas and all of my thoughts and you put someone else's name and face to it, people would take it at face value and be like, okay, yeah, that sounds good. But instead it turns into a lot of me saying things in meetings or at conferences or whatever, and people just kind of ignoring what I say, which I've been fortunate that I've had a lot of really great allies and mentors that have amplified me. So all of the advisors that I've had have been white men that have been really good at amplifying me, that always repeat what I say. And they always say, I agree with Jasmine, or I want to bring it back to what Jasmine said, which is super great to have someone that's in your corner that it's like, okay, apparently you didn't hear it when she said it. Let me repeat it and point it back.
The barrier that we wanted to address with Miss was the financial one. Because, you know, in marine science and in shark science, oftentimes you have to pay for your experiences or you're not getting paid. And a lot of minorities do not have that luxury. You know, I had the privilege of growing up with parents who had enough money to pay for me to go do things. But a lot of minorities do not have that, which is why for the workshop, we wanted to make it a fully funded thing, because then the money is not something they have to worry about. And the money isn't a barrier for them to know someone in this field, to have a role model, to have someone who can answer questions for them. And there's less of a like insane fight to even get an experience.
Yeah, and that's not the first time I've heard that pop up. So that seems to be a continuous theme. Diversity inclusion is financial barriers and making it affordable or free to get people into to have these experiences. But let's segue, continue on with the conversation about allies, mentors, and support structure.
Yeah, I think that having strong mentors is really super important. I think that getting a mentor is a barrier. you need need a mentor to get over the barriers, but getting a mentor is a barrier because typically people choose to show special interests in students that remind them of themselves. I think that is something that's hard. And if you're a minority student and you're sitting in a class and you already feel like you don't belong, you approaching a professor and getting to know them when you already feel like the space isn't yours is a big challenge. For the professors and people that are in the positions where they can mentor, they, you know, they have their things going on. They might say like, oh, this person reminds me of me as a student and I'm going to go help them out. That causes them to ignore the people that don't remind them of themselves. So typically the people that get noticed are the people that feel most comfortable in the space. So they have this sense of power already. So they're the ones answering all of the questions. They're the ones going to office hours. They're the ones that are reaching out to faculty. And the people that don't feel like it's their space and don't feel like they belong, don't feel comfortable raising their hand in class. Like, I never spoke in class, ever. I would know the answers, but I wouldn't want to put myself out there and say them. And so my advisor in undergrad, whenever he would talk to my professors, he would say like, oh, you probably have Jasmine in your class. She usually sits in her in the back and doesn't say anything, but she's actually brilliant. You should talk. So then I started having people that would come and talk to me, but I was not capable of taking that initiative at that stage of my life because I didn't feel like that was a good space for me. If you are in a position where you can mentor students, going out of your way to not just go for the people that are vocal and out there and remind you of themselves and maybe talk to the person that's not saying anything in class and see what they have to say, because there could be a brilliant mind sitting in the back of the class not talking. As far as allyship, I think it's really important for people to know that allies are going to make mistakes. I think a lot of people don't act as allies because they're afraid of messing up. Allyship is something that you have to do every day. It's not like an innate trait. You have to, in every situation, you choose to be an ally or not to be an ally. And sometimes you're going to step in and it's going to be great and the person's going to be very thankful for you. Sometimes you're actually going to put your foot in your mouth and someone's going to be like, okay, that wasn't helpful. And then you just say, sorry, tell me how to do better next time and I will do better next time. I think that people have like a paralyzing fear of messing up and so they don't act at all. Being an ally can be something as simple as like, oh, someone says something stupid, like, oh, Black people don't swim or whatever. And you stand there and literally all it takes is you going, what? And like, just, you know, pointing out, like not letting it just slide, pointing it out that like, that's not okay. And I have a friend that literally all she does is she goes, eek. Like anytime someone says something problematic, she just goes, eek. And then that stops them in their tracks of like, ooh, she just made a disapproving noise. Something I said wasn't okay. And like, she's very shy.
That's great. I'm going to start using that because I think that's one of the key things that white people have to step up and do, because you're right. It's a situation where people who want to be allies, it can be hard to break that mold and just let things go one ear out the other. And now I hear a lot of white people talk about this, speaking up and speaking out, just those little cues of disapproval. That is a great tip. So everybody listening to this podcast, take that to heart. Use that as a tool in your toolbox.
Going off of that a little bit, I once heard someone say, don't just be an ally, be an accomplice. So it's not just about not being racist. You have to be actively anti-racist every single day. Mm-hmm. So you pointing out those little things and saying, eek, fantastic. If you see someone harassing a person of color, maybe that person of color is afraid to speak up against it for fear of retaliation. But if you, as a white person, were to help speak up, maybe that would make them feel a little bit more comfortable, or at the very least be a person that they can turn to be like, hey, this just happened today. What do you think I should do about it? Or like, can you help me? Or like whatever else. It is so exhausting to be the only one to have to speak up against all of these things that are happening to you, because if they happen so often and you have to then point it out or try to tell somebody about it or report it every time time it happens, you're just like, I don't have this energy. And then it's just going to go unreported half the time. If someone else is going to be there and be your ally, your accomplice to help you with reporting those things or pointing them out, or at least just like being there for you, like that's super, super helpful. So I would encourage white people to do those things, to help report, to say eek when you hear a gross comment, to be like, walk up to a person of color and say, hey man, I'm sorry that happened to you. Is there anything I can do? Anything like that. I think that that's really important. And then going off of the whole quiet person in the classroom, in that aspect, I am the exact opposite of Jasmine. I sat front row and I was like, hey, I have a question, or oh my gosh, I know the answer to that question. And I would answer so confidently, even if I wasn't sure if it was right or not, because nobody else was answering the questions. I was like, I'll do it. I think I felt comfortable, or I guess more comfortable, because I grew up in predominantly white spaces. So when I got to college and I was in another predominantly white space, I was just like, yeah, okay, like this is where I've been my whole life. So whatever, this doesn't bother me. I mean, it was definitely something that I noticed. I was like, there are very many people of color in this classroom, or I'm the only black person in this classroom. So it's definitely something that I noticed, but it wouldn't necessarily stop me from calling things out or asking questions or answering questions or being like, hey, do you have any undergrad research opportunities or anything like that? Just because in general, I'm such a loud, vocal, outgoing, energetic person. That's just who I am and who I've always been. But I think that it is really important to make sure that the people in the classroom that maybe aren't speaking up are still getting the attention they need and deserve, because just because they're not speaking up doesn't mean that they're not smart or that they don't have ambition. It just means that they might not be as extroverted as I am, or they might not be as comfortable as I am. And that's totally fine. Like you don't have to be an extrovert and loud to be seen in your space. Or you shouldn't have to be extroverted and loud to be seen in your space. So making sure as a mentor, you are able to pick those people out of the crowd and actively seek them out and try and help them, especially if you think maybe they don't remind you of yourself, like Jasmine was saying. I think that's really important and can be really helpful, and make sure that those people who are more shy are really feeling heard, because I think that that's really important too. So yeah, I just wanted to jump on to Jasmine's comment. But yeah, that's what I got.
I'm going to piggyback off of what both of them said to say that, you know, if you are a mentor who is someone who is known for calling people out for saying comments that they should not be saying, and if you are someone who is known for going above and beyond with like calling on people of color in class, you know, making sure that they're heard, talking to them even if they're quiet and don't feel like they can talk to you, that puts you in a position where students of color will feel more comfortable talking to you. You know, I took this job at field school because I am 100% confident that if someone in the field said anything remotely disrespectful to me, that the five of them would say something. And I feel safe doing field work with them because I know that they'll have my back if someone says something to me because I'm a woman or because I'm black. That's not something that a lot of people of color can feel, especially with their mentors, if their mentor is not outwardly being anti-racist and then actively showing that.
All those are great points. What are some of your challenges as women in the field of shark research?
I have seen to other people and to myself a few instances of people thinking, maybe you're not strong enough. Like, you're so small. Are you sure you're going to be able to handle a shark? Or sharks are a guy thing, or anything like that. I'm like, this is so dismissive. And I don't understand why it would be an issue for a woman to try to work on sharks. It really just does not make sense to me. Like, animals are animals. I don't understand why like sharks are for guys and dolphins are for girls. Like, that just doesn't make any sense to me. So for people to be like, are you sure you want to work on sharks? Like, are you strong enough to hold one down? I'm like, I will be fine. I promise you. I know what I'm getting myself into. I know a lot about these animals. I understand that they are like pure muscle and super, super strong. I promise that I will be fine. I will have a team of people with me, whether it's all women or a ton of men or whatever. Like, we're going to figure it out, and we will work on these sharks, and we will do what we need to do, because I know what I'm getting myself into, and I know what research I want to do. So regardless of your opinion and how women aren't strong enough, I will show you that we are strong enough, and I'm going to do what I need to do. And then you can sit down and be quiet, because your comments are irrelevant to my life.
Absolutely. Do you find that in some way, like you're meeting that challenge, you're proving people wrong, so it even gives you more motivation?
I would say it absolutely does, just because you have all these people telling you can't do something, whether it's because you're black or because you're a woman or whatever else. So many people telling you that you can't do this, or maybe you should think about doing this, or I think it'll be really difficult or whatever else. And I'm just like, well, challenges are a good thing. Like, if you're not challenging yourself, like, are you not bored? Like, I don't understand. I continuously challenge myself, and I just don't understand why some people feel the need to try and put me down for that, or any anybody down for trying to challenge themselves and doing something they love. So I'm just going to continue to do what I do and what I love. And anyone that has a problem with it will very soon realize that they have no reason to have a problem with it. And they're either going to stay mad or they'll be like, hey, you know what? I was wrong. Good for her. It is a motivation. My main motivation is just doing what I love and being happy in my research. But if I can prove some haters wrong in the process, I mean, that's a bonus. So
yeah, I'll echo what Jada said. It's just a lot of people think that you're not strong enough. And like literally every time I'm trailering a boat, people think that I'm incompetent for reasons. Trailing the boat, driving the boat, apparently our extra X chromosome makes us incapable of doing things with vehicles, which is silly. But yeah, like I've had instances where, so my advisor is known for being very welcoming and open and stuff. And so he has people of color and women, a lot of women apply to be in SLAB. And so there's points where we're doing research and everyone on the boat besides him is a woman. He's the only man on the boat. And so we'll be going out and there'll be like fishing guides that'll say stuff like, oh, what are you guys doing? And say, oh, we're fishing for sharks. And it's like, oh, like they're kind of like, oh, you handle sharks all by yourself? And then he'll just be like, there are four other people on this boat. Like, no, I'm not doing it by myself. And so people make comments like that, like, oh, well, you don't know what you're doing. Or people that try to tell me, like, whenever I'm doing something on the boat, they'll be like, oh, you got to do it like this. But I'm like, I'm sorry, I know how to drive a boat. Like, don't tell me what to do. So stuff like that. It's just little annoying things that apparently people have decided that women are incapable of doing for reasons I don't understand.
Imani, it sounds like you had something as well.
I was going to piggyback off of both of what they said. You know, the doubt that you as a woman know anything about what you're doing is like the first thing that people think. They're like, they question your knowledge constantly. They question your ability to handle a shark constantly. And, you know, when you watch women tag sharks and handle sharks versus men, it's a completely different technique because we have a different body build than men do, but we are equally as able to handle a strong shark. The idea that you have to have physical muscle mass that you can see on your body to be strong enough to handle a shark is completely incorrect. And I think as women, people automatically think you can't do it because you don't have the apparent muscles that men have. And we are equally as capable handling sharks as men are.
I also wanted to add that it's very frustrating when people are constantly questioning you on something that you've been studying for years. So you'll have people come up to you and be like, oh, you're an expert in this. Well, why don't you tell me this, this, and this? And I'm like, I have nothing to prove to you. Like, you're not the expert in this, but I am. Like, I don't understand why you're trying to quiz me on something that I've known for a long time. Like, unless you are like my PhD committee, you have no reason to be quizzing me to make sure that I know these. And then there's a lot of like the well, actually people. You'll tell them something like, oh, did you know that the salmon shark is at least partially endothermic? And they're like, well, actually, and then try to explain something else. And I'm like, but first of all, what you're about to say is probably the same thing that I just said, because what I just said is an accurate statement, or what you're about to say is not at all correct. And there's no reason for you to be talking. Like, there's no reason to correct somebody that has been doing this for a really long time and clearly knows what they're doing. But that seems to happen a lot as a Black person and as a woman. It's really irritating, so but
constantly just being tested.
Yeah, you just kind of ignore it. I'm like, I don't really have anything to prove to you. If you really want to make sure that I know what I'm talking about, go read publications or go watch some of my talks or whatever else. So I'm like, I don't have time for this. I've explained this 1,000 times. Go find your resources. They're online somewhere, I promise.
Sometimes you just got to do that. What's next for your initiative? And what are some of the long-term goals for MIS?
I would say, I mean, there's a ton of things that we want to do with MIS. We just keep coming up with new ideas because we're all so excited about this.
I bet.
I'd say one of our biggest long-term goals is just creating a space for women of color in shark science and creating a welcoming space for them. You know, giving them access to us and to mentors that we've had that we know are good mentors for women and for women of color. You know, we want to do outreach with younger women of color to try to get them interested early on in shark science and marine science and show them that they can do whatever they want from an early age. All of us want to be role models because all of us didn't have role models that looked like us. And so we want MIS to be a place where where a young girl can, you know, look at all the people involved with us and see tons of role models. They think to herself, like, wow, I can do shark science because look at all these people succeeding in the field that look like me.
Yeah, we're looking to create networking opportunities, provide support and resources for people wanting to attend conferences, professional development things, ways that they can present their research in a welcoming space so they can build that confidence before they go somewhere else that might not feel as welcoming. Like Amani said, doing some outreach with the younger women to get them excited about shark science. And because I think there's a lot of people that have the interest super early on, and then they have someone say like, oh, you can't be a shark scientist because XYZ. And then they go, okay, well, I'll do something else. I want to make sure that we reach those people before someone has a chance to discourage them from doing what they really want
to
do.
I'd really love to show off this great website and talk about the workshop. And then specifically, we want people out there, the listeners, to donate as much money as they can to this important cause. So let's talk about your website and what's involved there, your upcoming workshop and ways to donate.
Our website is www.misselasmo.org. There's a lot of information on there. You can learn about the four of us, Carly included. She's not here today, but that's okay. You learn about the four of us, the founders, and you can learn about our workshops, some of our initiatives, and there is a donate button. So you can go on our website and donate. And we also have a Patreon that you can subscribe to with a small donation. Any donations would be incredibly helpful. They will go towards helping women of color feel comfortable in this field. And that is really, really important. And our workshops, we're really, really excited about them. So there's going to be two workshops this spring, one in March, one in April. We're going to have 9 participants for each one come out and live on a field school vessel for 3 days. And there will be experiences in shark tagging, potential snorkeling opportunities. There will also be some really important conversations of what it's like to be a woman of color in the field of marine and shark sciences. So I think that that's going to be really important, really helpful for these students. Hopefully we can make them feel as comfortable as possible and really excited to move forward with their careers. We're just really excited to start helping as many people as we possibly can.
Yeah, and I see you've put together this awesome promo video on YouTube. So everyone out there, click on that, see what they're all about. We can help these ladies. So let's do it.
I just want to add that in terms of donations, we're also looking for, you know, companies who want to donate goodies for the people who participate in our workshop. We'd really love to do, you know, gift bags or something for them. So if any of the listeners know someone who would be interested in potentially donating some t-shirts, you know, stickers, anything, we would absolutely appreciate it.
I'll also add that you can follow us on Instagram and Twitter as well at @Miss_Elasmo. I will also say that as of Monday, we hit our $25,000 goal, but we need more continued funding to run past this year. So now we're looking to next year. So anything that we can get kickstarted on next year's fundraising, that would be super helpful so we can spend more time doing programming and things like that and less time worrying about fundraising money. Definitely still send in those donations. We're very excited and feel very supported by the community coming, rallying around, helping us reach our goal. And it would be super great if we could keep this momentum going and fundraise even more so we can know that we're going to have a sustainable program. Click that Patreon link on our website or that donate button.
So there's some key terms that these ladies have mentioned throughout this podcast that are really important to diversity, inclusion, and equity training. They've mentioned microaggressions, creating space and those spaces being safe. They mentioned imposter syndrome and allies. These are all key terms that people should look up. Listeners, if you're out there, keep in mind this terminology and start thinking about this stuff. All right. Well, we really appreciate your time today. Thank you very much, Amani, Jada, and Jasmine. Dedication from individuals like you and initiatives like the Minorities in Shark Sciences. The future really looks brighter. Keep up the great work. But there's a lot to accomplish. So I thank you all for joining me.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Special thanks to the American Fisheries Society for hosting this podcast on www.fisheries.org and providing support to maintain the podcast. This episode was produced and edited by Aaron Bunch, myself, and Dion Kerr. The custom lo-fi music beat was crafted by Darius Armstrong. Look for his music name, Karl Marx, on www.karlmarx.bandcamp.com/releases. We are very grateful to all of those AFS leaders and members who have provided support and feedback as we have brought this podcast to life.